This is community radio from Sonoma County and the world. This is KWTF in Bodega Bay, and now another edition of Voices from Behind the Walls with your host, Elbert Big Man Howard.
This is Voices from Behind the Wall with your host, Elbert Big Man Howard. And we'll be reading the final chapters from Eddie Marshall's Martial Law. And we will conclude it today and hope that we have imparted the information that Eddie was doing his best to get down and get out. That Eddie, with the assistance of Dominic Stevens. So stay tuned, and we hope that this has been enlightenment and information for the public and the community.
This is Marty McReynolds, and we're reading the epilogue to the book, To be uprooted for destinations unknown is an unpleasant experience at best, one that echoes back to another time and place where men, women, and children were snatched against their will and delivered as goods into another land. An experience that marked the end of the Maryland House of Corrections reawakened in me that memory that never really sleeps, but has long been hidden in my subconscious, what it felt like to be enslaved. It was an experience that, when coupled with what seemed to be a secret lottery in which a few prisoners were selected and disappeared each day, amounted to psychological torture. That torment became a part of the daily routine for 1,300 men at the Maryland House of Corrections at Jessup in the late summer of 2006. The following is what I wrote at the time. Each day starts with cups of cold food shoved into our cells. These cells have been locked 24 hours a day for 45 days straight. Twice more before the day is done, these cold cups of food will be delivered. For the men who are locked in, there are no visits, no telephones, no religious services, no schools, and no purchases from the prison commissary. Many families do not know what is happening with their loved ones, and the frequent media reports concerning violent incidents at the facility do not help the situation. The hospital is the one exception where movement is concerned. Prisoners are receiving their medications. The lockdown has even affected those minor things that so many take for granted. Personal hygiene. There is no soap, toothpaste, or deodorant. Most prisoners are only receiving showers twice a week. Tempers have been flaring, anger seething just below the surface in many of the men. After hours of boredom in their cells, a guard calls for attention from the prisoners. He calls out 2-3 names: Moore, Washington, Miller, pack up, you're moving. An hour later, as they take away the latest victims, someone asks where they are going. We don't know, but we'll be back tomorrow for more, the guard replies. The rest of the prisoners are reminded of the slave ships that took Africans away. Later that night, most of the prisoners are asleep. However, somewhere among the dirty, half-nourished, angry men lurks the dream of payback. Freedom has taken a backseat to revenge. It is a rage born of this new degree of oppression, and once unleashed, it will likely expend itself among the prisoners. Prisoners, like other oppressed people, tend to take the anger out on each other. It is a seemingly unending cycle of violence. Conway, the guard called my name today and threw bags at me. Pack up. You're moving. I would eventually end up at the Maryland Correctional Training Center at Hagerstown. The place is cold and mean in the way that the slave pens must have been. The buildings are newer, yet they possess the bad institutional karma incurred from being ill-used. The mostly white guard staff is a throwback to a distant time and place, yet they patrol the prison as if there had been no space between the enslavement of Africans and the so-called war on drugs. The fact that this region of the state had been the least accommodating to slavery in Maryland is at odds with the present. Yet the poverty of the area makes it dependent on the prison industry. Young African-descended men are the predominant group on the yard, and many of them walk around the facility in a trance-like state, playing their Game Boys. It makes me think of those stories of the young African children who were reputed to have been lured onto the slave ships with red cloths. The drug game has become the new lure, and it is quickly reeling them into the hold of this new vessel, the criminal justice system. Before landing in this facility, I had been involved in a program at the Maryland House of Corrections that some of us prisoners operated in partnership with the American Friends Service Committee. The Service Committee is a Quaker organization, and I was drawn to it based on the history of the Religious Society of Friends and their involvement in the anti-slavery movement during the 19th century. I felt that the AFSC was often on the correct side of many issues, and it was my belief that they were one of the few organizations still doing the work that many of us had begun in the late 60s. So when some members of an AFSC program called the Third World Coalition approached me about supporting me and providing assistance with my case, I asked them to consider working with a broader segment of the prison population. The Maryland Peace with Justice Program, a program of the AFSC Middle Atlantic region, soon got involved, and we began organizing sessions that focused on conflict resolution and leadership development with incarcerated veterans. This program began in 2002 and continued up until the closing of the House of Corrections in 2006. The staff at AFSC recognized the value of this type of programming for prisoners, and they were committed to carrying it out. Often at the house, the tears would be a buzz after a particularly stimulating session or an inspiring speaker. So when the program was forced to end because of the lockdown and subsequent closure of the House of Corrections, the staff met with then-Secretary of Public Safety, Marianne Saar, and she made it possible for them to begin working with those of us from the group who had ended up in MCTC, the Maryland Correctional Training Center. Three of us from the original group at the house, Ronald Thomas Bay, James Hopkins, who we all called Bear, and myself, got together with several other men from the population and developed a mentoring program that would come to be known as a friend of a friend. The name comes from the term that was often used as people were passing through a safe house on the Underground Railroad, and obviously it reflects our relationship to the Quaker organization. The people who have supported and participated in this program from beyond the prison walls have been immensely helpful. I've seen the magic up close. Young men who are initially skeptical or just ambivalent have become focused and committed to change. It not only helps them better navigate conflict, but makes them think in a more critical way about issues that affect their communities. Our goal has been to equip these young men to leave prison in a better position emotionally and intellectually than when they came in. Our great hope is that they will contribute to the uplift of the communities that they come from. I've been happy to see some of these men go back out into their communities and work with youth. They have created a spin-off project, a cafe called Neutral Grounds, that runs out of the AFSC offices on York Road in Baltimore to help sustain them financially. This project also serves as a source of hope for the hundreds of prisoners who participate in A Friend of a Friend. It is something that they all can see, a culmination of the work that has taken place inside. It is our collective prayer for self-determination. In this place, the older prisoners who demonstrate that they are straightforward and striving to better themselves and their people become father figures. This is a role I've frequently filled, and though it requires a lot of my time and energy, I gladly accept it, because I know that for many of these young men, a healthy relationship with a father or grandfather has been lacking. There are a number of reasons for this, and perhaps the most obvious from where I sit is the absence created by the burgeoning prison population. Women and men have been disappeared into a system that is unaccommodating of families' needs. The drug trade has passed through generations, much like carpentry or bricklaying would have a century ago. I have a godson who found his first positive role model only once he was incarcerated. For anyone who ever bought into the myth that the bad guys are behind those bars, let this give them pause. I am surrounded by men who, had it not been for a drug addiction, might otherwise be upstanding members of their communities. The situational hostility between the various street organizations sometimes lends itself to ironic, if not comedic, episodes within the prison. Here, it is not unusual to see rivals flying their colors from wheelchairs and beefing back and forth. These are individuals who could not readily defend themselves from an attack by a child, men who are suffering a paralysis that is physical in nature as well as cultural, intellectual, and spiritual. If Maryland were Iraq, then the North Branch Correctional Institute, NBCI, in Cumberland, Maryland, would be Abu Ghraib. Located in a very remote area in the western part of the state, this facility is Maryland's newest and most ultra-modern prison. After the scandal at Abu Ghraib, it was revealed that some of the guards who were involved in that situation had previously been staffing prisons in western Maryland, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. North Branch had only been open for a couple of years before there were reports of beatings, rebellions, and the death of a prisoner at the hands of guards. So when I woke up one morning and discovered that I was scheduled to be transferred to North Branch for no specific reason, I must admit that I was shocked. Even though I had been in the system for 3 decades at that point and should have been prepared for anything. Besides overcoming my own momentary shock, I had to quell the anger of several prisoners in my housing unit who were mad as hell about my removal. These young brothers wanted to tear the prison up, but I knew that regardless of the cause for this most recent affront upon me, a riot would be used to justify my transfer to North Branch. So I packed my belongings and made the 200-mile trip to North Branch via Department of Corrections bus. There were nearly 24 other men from MCTC being transferred that day, and I had a chance to speak with most of them as we traveled to the new prison. Everyone on the bus that day felt that they were targeted for some organizing or work that they were doing at the prison, or some label that the guards had arbitrarily applied to them because of their perceived political orientation and/or relationship to other prisoners. For example, one man had a brother who was a gang member, and even though this man was not affiliated, he was seen talking to his brother, and he assumed that this resulted in his transfer. Another man was the leader of a large Muslim community, and he had spoken out when another prisoner had been beaten in front of him. Yet another had simply been reading books about the history and culture of people of African descent. As the bus moved toward North Branch, the stories continued, and it made me think about the numerous stories that our ancestors must have shared about their capture as the slave ships carried them toward an unknown destination. I then realized how I had arrived at that particular juncture. I had been spending most of my time working on my master's thesis for the University of California. Each day I would gather my books and materials, sit at a table in the recreation area, and work on the paper. In addition to this, I was also mentoring a number of prisoners, helping them prepare for parole and cope with problems they were facing. Often, one or another of these young men would see me seated at this table and come over to discuss a problem or ask a question. I would put my work aside and take some time to address the situation. I suppose the guards found me guilty of two crimes. The first was reading material about black people, especially the Black Panther Party. My thesis was on BPP political prisoners, and these books reflected that topic. The second offense was simply speaking to youthful prisoners, African-descended and white, and answering their questions as well as helping them navigate through the system. The guards actually claim that navigation is their territory, but they hardly ever talk to young prisoners other than to issue instructions and commands. Now here I was, being shipped off to this place that was hundreds of miles from the city where my family resided. This is sometimes the reward for the man behind bars who educates himself and those around him. Still, I was pissed and ready, willing, and able to fight when I touched ground at North Branch, another angry black man joining the thousand or so already there. The building that we were housed in was being filled to capacity with prisoners from around the state. There was another building that held several hundred men who were locked in their cells all day and all night. The prison employed a portable shower that was pushed down the tier once a day. The windows in the cells were kept closed, and each cell faced a wall. The people who are contained within this area cannot see themselves because the mirrors and other utilities are made with dull stainless steel finishes. There is an intercom system built into each cell wall, and cameras hang overhead in all areas to record any movement and activity. Privacy is but a vague memory on its way to becoming a long-forgotten concept in that place. The housing unit in which we had been placed was built the same way, though it was deemed medium security, and many of us were classified that way. The difference for us was that we were allowed out of the cells for yard, recreation room, and to go to eat and shower. Each cell was doubled up with two men, and the tier that I was on held over 100 men. This building had four such tiers. Everything was high-tech, and prisoners could be locked down in any area at the first sign of trouble simply by the flip of a switch or touch of a button. All around us, above our heads, was a control center with large windows and monitors. Some areas also held one-way glass. Every door was closed, and a prisoner had to approach it and wait for it to open to allow travel to the next door, where the wait began again. My first day at this facility set the tone for the entire experience. I arrived with all of my property, an accumulation of 30-plus years behind bars, which was then inspected by several guards. Most of it was rejected because so many things were prohibited at this particular prison. I lost hundreds of dollars worth of property, a television, books, tapes, food, pictures, clothes, and many small items that I had collected over the years. Some of the other prisoners said that we could fight for our belongings and they would have to return it in the next 3 or 4 months. I resolved right then that my fight would be to get out of North Branch, for there was no real justification for my being placed there to begin with. This place was a 21st century concentration camp, where the guards, with few exceptions, were hostile, and the cells were filling fast with young men and teenagers of African descent, mostly from Baltimore and Prince George's County, Maryland. I witnessed several conflicts with the guards, and three of them resulted in the tear gassing of the tier that I was on. Immediately following my transfer to North Branch, my sister Cookie and several of my supporters waged a campaign to get me sent back to MCTC, along with two other young men who were part of the mentoring program that I had been involved with. After 2 weeks or so, I was asked by officials to ask my supporters, who had not only made calls to the Department of Public Safety, but had held a demonstration outside of their offices, to call the campaign off because I would be sent back to MCTC in Hagerstown. In addition, one of the two young brothers was also sent back. Our other comrade had been placed on lockup when he stood up for another prisoner who was being mistreated by the guards, and because of this he was not returned. As I left that place after what amounted to a 30-day stint, I couldn't help but wonder about the men who remained there. Brothers, young and old, were being stripped of their humanity by the pound. Many of them, and especially the young ones, would return to their communities full of anger and without much hope for the future, nursing a profound sense of loss for something that no human should ever lose. This experience made me extremely grateful for the spiritual soul-searching that I had done some 30 years before. I always felt out of sync spiritually. The pieces were there, but they were not all together. Out of the criticisms often levied at the Panthers is that we lacked a spiritual base to our movement. On the surface, this is true. However, I always took to heart the quote by Che Guevara that says that the true revolutionary is guided by great feelings of love. We were a revolutionary organization in the throes of removing the shackles of a few hundred years of Western influence and dominance, but at the core was a righteous love for our communities and people. Love, like most emotions, is spirit-based. It possesses us and bends us to its will. In my case, that spirit was seeking freedom for Black people, and I've always been bent on that pursuit. However, I have felt at times that my spirit was not fully connected to the universe. Many of us who were in the Panther Party were young people who had come from families that had been Christians since enslavement. I had grown up attending a community church, and beyond the love that I had for the beautiful hymns, it never reached me. The same people who would act as if they were in righteous possession of the Spirit on Sunday would allow the toxic gods to inhabit their souls during the rest of the week. I wanted to be connected to a religion that practiced what was preached. So I gave Islam a try, even though my political beliefs and ideologies were in conflict with some of the religious teachings. From 1975 to 1980, I was Sunni Muslim. I took the name of Hashim Sal al-Din, which means the sword of the law. Orthodox Islam had been making an inroad into the Black liberation movement because it offered a spiritual connection to some of our closest international allies. Some of our members had been given safe haven by Islamic nations and perhaps were even trained by Islamic groups. They were engaged in a fight against the same Western imperialist forces we were battling, and the movement was being flooded with books and materials on the struggle of Islamic nations. On a more personal level, the peaceful air projected by the brothers during Ramadan and after prayer gatherings was a state of being that I longed to obtain. I tried to keep my politics and religion in their respective areas, but ultimately these diverse beliefs collided. I found Islam fraught with too many Eurocentric and capitalist beliefs, and I had spent too much time rejecting these harmful tenets to go back. The rejection had cost me my physical freedom. That's how deep my commitments were. The true relationship between Black Africa and the Islamic world was becoming clear as the wars for liberation on the continent did not receive support from the Islamic countries, and in some cases were met with military opposition. As I studied and learned more about the spread of Islam, I was confronted with the facts. This had resulted in the destruction of many African cultures and societies. It was during this 5-year period that I would learn that just like the Christian church, Islam had its share of Friday worshippers. While some of us were very serious about our religious practices, there were others who were dealing in heavy drugs and engaged in other activities that I found unacceptable. Too many problems and not enough rewards. My soul was still unhappy. For 3 years after I left Islam, I continued to observe the holy days and keep aspects of the religion that I felt were purifying, but let go of the theological aspects. I became increasingly cynical toward organized religion and of any sort, though I always maintained my own connection to the Creator. And I have continued to look toward Africa as I have searched for spiritual enlightenment. I am currently incarcerated at the Jessup Correctional Institution, JCI, in Jessup, Maryland. I was moved here in July of 2008 after Greg Kane wrote a story for the Baltimore Sun about flagging, a term used when the Department of Corrections has identified an individual as a member of a gang or what they consider a security threat group. While still at the House of Corrections, I had been photographed for the gang catalog, even though I have never been a member of any of these organizations. When I inquired why I was being placed in the catalog, I was told it was because I had been a member of the BPP. Greg Kane's column suggested that some people were being flagged simply because they were attempting to intervene between the various organizations or because of their political orientation and cultural perspectives. And there was a quote attributed to me. As I have said, nothing remains secret for very long inside of a prison. A week after the column ran, I heard through the prison grapevine that I was going to be moved to JCI. After the move to North Branch, I had kept some things packed and prepared to move any time. So when they came for me that morning, I was already prepared for the trip. Now I am simply preparing for the day when the trip will be uptown rather than to another institution. I know that day is coming. This is Marty McReynolds again, and here's a piece about Marshall Eddie Conway that was written as part of the introduction to his book, The Greatest Threat, and it was written by Dominique Stevenson. It says, in 1970, 23-year-old Eddie Conway was a key member of the Baltimore chapter of the Black Panther Party. Raised in East Baltimore in a working-class neighborhood, he spent his summers riding the vegetable carts of the city's Arabers. It was while working with the men who sold produce from neighborhood to neighborhood that he first noticed the stark difference between the more affluent white neighborhoods and the largely poor black environs similar to where he lived. At age 16, Eddie sought an escape from the eat its young environment of urban America. He joined the United States Army and spent several years stationed in Europe. It was while he mourned the death of a childhood friend killed in Vietnam and contemplated a tour designed to exact some sort of revenge that he experienced a rude awakening from his American dream. Shocked by a newspaper photo of an armored tank pointed at a group of black women during the outbreak of resistance in Newark in the summer of 1967, Eddie left the Army and returned to the U.S. with a resolve to change the conditions that existed in his community. After the Baltimore Rebellion of 1968 that followed the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., Eddie decided to join the Black Panther Party in order to effectively change the conditions in his community. The rebellion had momentarily stripped away the many layers of apathy and neglect that separated Baltimore's black community from the rest of the city. Shortly after joining the party, Eddie exposed irregularities on the part of one of the founding members of the chapter. It would later be determined that this member was a government informant working on behalf of the National Security Agency, NSA. Under the auspices of the government's counterintelligence program, both federal and state law enforcement agencies placed informants in the Baltimore chapter. This was a tactic developed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, to disrupt the activities of the Black Panther Party. In April of 1970, Eddie was arrested and charged in the disappearance of an informer. These charges would eventually be dropped. However, while in police custody, Eddie was charged in the shooting death of a Baltimore City police officer and the assault of another. Despite an incredible lack of evidence, Eddie was convicted and received a sentence of life in prison for a crime that he maintains that he did not commit. Eddie Conway has spent 4 decades of his life in the netherworld of the Maryland prison system, and during that time, he has become one of the most well-known U.S. political prisoners. The greatest threat is the This book is the product of a man who has experienced the dirty tricks of COINTELPRO firsthand, survived an indifferent criminal justice system, beatings by guards, lockdowns, and riots, yet still preserved his humanity.
Okay, as Eddie Marshall Conway insists that he is a political prisoner, from his writings and The Greatest Threat, he explains what a political prisoner is. Most individuals who have been labeled as political prisoners arrive at that position because they were protesting injustice, resisting oppression, fighting for liberation, or framed by the government as a result of former activities. The discovery of COINTELPRO operations that resulted in unfair trials for several BPP members caused Amnesty International to change its position. Until recently, Amnesty International only recognized cases that did not involve violence. Now, however, the organization recognizes and supports cases where the question of a fair trial is paramount. Leonard Peltier is a case in point, who was the Native American accused of killing an FBI agent as the FBI assaulted the reservation, the Lakota reservation at Pine Ridge. Other mainstream organizations such as American Friends Service Committees, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People have added their voices to call for the release of political prisoners in America. The subject of political prisoners is of great concern and interest to the movement. The U.S. government is in concert with state and local law enforcement officials, orchestrates and executes with military precision a worldwide malicious disinformation campaign of criminalizing political activists and leaders. They, as we, are classified as terrorists. Nevertheless, out of necessity or convenience, the U.S. government recognizes and acts upon political prisoner status when it suits their purpose. An excellent example of political role reversal by the government can be seen in Jill Dawson's article, U.S. Delisting China Upsets Right Activists, in the Washington Post. The Black Panther Party was clearly a revolutionary opposition organization to the U.S. government and those the government represented. The Black Panther Party did pose a threat to the U.S. government, not in numbers, but rather in words and deeds. The examples of organizing for self-defense and self-determination were too much for the U.S. homogeneous paradigm. The opposition that the BPP presented to the U.S. world image could have been crushed. That would have been easy enough militarily, but the real problem of ideas would remain. It was necessary to not just destroy the BPP, but also to demonize and criminalize its action to dissuade future generations from its course. COINTELPRO was successful in its goal. Nearly 40 years later, many of its victims still languish in America's prisons as demonized criminals and not as political prisoners. This is Elbert Big Man Howard, your host for Voices from Behind the Walls. And you've heard, in his own words, the story of Marshall Eddie Conway from his book, Martial Law. And we want to thank our readers of this material, Marty McReynolds, David Ingalls, our audio engineer, David Campos, and the listening audience. So the next voice you'll hear, which will conclude this, will be the voice of Marshall Eddie Conway himself.
Basically, I was born in Baltimore City in 1946, and I spent my youth moving between East Baltimore and West Baltimore until I was around 18. I joined the U.S. Army and went to Europe for 3 years, from like 1964 to 1967. During that period, I became aware of institutional racism in the Army between white soldiers and black soldiers, and the conditions in which we were living under in the barracks at night, with forays into our barracks by the Ku Klux Klan and stuff like that. I start becoming aware of the politics of America after the assassination of Malcolm X. And I did some organizing in Europe, and I decided, well, instead of going to Vietnam, which I had initially decided to do, I would return to the United States and see what was going on. And one of the triggering events that caused me to make that decision was the riots in early 67 in New Jersey and in other cities, in which the Army actually occupied the black community and in some cases locked up all the males in the communities and left the women in the communities and kind of like ransacked all the houses. I woke up one morning and saw one of these particular stories in the Army newspapers, Stars and Stripes, and I was like actually shocked that I was getting ready to go to Vietnam to make the world safe for democracy. And in fact, the very army that I was in the black community, oppressing the black community. So I decided to leave the army, come home and see what I could do to participate in the civil activities to make America better for black folks. After getting home, I joined like the NAACP and CORE and tried to integrate, we integrated various workplaces, Spurs Point, but conditions just continued to get worse. And the integration part was good, but at the same time, this was like to around 68, 69. Actually, this was the start of jobs leaving the black community and being shipped overseas, and conditions were deteriorating in the community, along with the influx of drugs that was just starting to kind of bombard the black community. So I decided that, well, more serious kind of activities need to take place in order to kind of like protect the black community and create conditions that would conducive to like the development of young children and so on. So looking around in other organizations, I actually decided that the Black Panther Party was the best possible hope at that time for the black community. And so I investigated, found the office, you know, and joined. At that time, in Baltimore, the Black Panther Party office was not a very serious operation. There was a lot of partying going on, a lot of young people, and a lot of things that didn't reflect what the national organization was reflecting or what the newspaper was advocating. So toward that end, I got in the organization with the understanding that I would try to do whatever I could do to make it become a more serious. And in the process, I discovered that the organization was set up by the National Security Agent, Warren Hart, which was a captain at that time. And apparently he had been put...
You said National Security Agent. Saying National Security Agent for the Black Panther Party, or
no,
are you saying
no,
for
the United States government's National Security Agency
had set up a chapter, Baltimore chapter.
Yes, had mandated that this guy Warren Hart come to Baltimore and actually organize a Black Panther Party, and they did this with the intention of having Baltimore have a seat in the Central Committee during the regular meetings in California. And Warren Hart operated in Baltimore for, it was actually discovered after I investigated it, and he actually left Baltimore after a thorough investigation, and he infiltrated Stokely Carmichael's organization up in Canada, where he was exposed again, and then he actually then went down into the Caribbean and got involved in another kind of government scheme.
Now this is, I'm sorry, I just want to be clear, this is, you're saying the National Security Agency?
The National, NSA, out of D.C., that does all the monitoring of the electronics communications around the world. Well, they also had actually agents operating, just like the FBI and the CIA and and other agencies. In his particular case, he was ex-Army intelligence, and I guess when he got out, he started working for them. I actually identified him and exposed him and got, you know, the apparatus in the Black Panther Party to actually have a thorough investigation of him. And that investigation caused him to, like, flee the state. And, of course, we didn't know where he went. And we actually didn't discover that he was in Canada, which at that time was the place where a lot of the FBI agent provocateurs and a lot of the COINTELPRO, because COINTELPRO wasn't all, and I'll explain what COINTELPRO is in a little while, wasn't all FBI agents. Some of them were local police agents, some of them were state police agency, some of them were military intelligence and other agencies. It was a conglomerate of different people working under one umbrella, which the FBI was operating. But most of them, once they were discovered, went to Canada. They had a actually place up in Canada where they were taking them. He went to Canada, and the All African People's Revolutionary Party discovered him up there, and he fled again. But because I had exposed him and caused the initial investigation and kind of like took away their main agent that they was using to infiltrate the Oakland headquarters, the Black Panther Party national headquarters, I believe I became a target of COINTELPRO. And I think that is what resulted in me being here now, you know, as being targeted. Of course, they had already had opened a file on me. They were trying to get me fired from my job. And they were following me around. Of course, they were following everybody around, you know. So I think months before this particular incident, they had created another incident in which they had contributed to the Baltimore Black Panther Party and basically sent word to us that, well, we're locking all of y'all up for conspiracy for, like, murdering one of our agent provocateurs or police informants. And that
this
was
Eugene Anderson.
Yeah, this is the Eugene Anderson case, and that was like sometime in November they sent word to us, and pretty much it was to kind of like intimidate us or cause us to flee.
This is November?
This is November of 69, you know. And so in April, they had an actual police incident up in West Baltimore in which one police was killed, and I think a black man was killed in the process.
That is the voice of Marshall Eddie Conway, and we have finished up the reading of Martial Law by Marshall Eddie Conway and Dominique Stevenson. My thanks to your host, Albert Big Man Howard, and readings by Marty McReynolds, David Engels, and Robert Edmonds. My name is Don Compo. You're listening to KWTF Community Radio for Sonoma County and the world, KWTF in Bodega Bay. Please help us out if you think that these programs are important and all the other programs that we have here on KWTF by going to our website and becoming a member today or pledging some type of donation for us or volunteer work even. All of that information is available at kwtf.net. Coming up next on KWTF, it's the best hip-hop in the North Bay with A.D. Brathett and his show called Standout. Stay tuned for more great information and entertainment here on Community Radio for Sonoma County and the world, KWTF.
Twilight, I'm on my way home. moving on.